Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And let's say when you flick on your computer at work, you bring up a live webcam of some adorable puppies and kitties like these to get the sympathetic endorphins flowing, to put a smile on your face, or say you log on to your infant child fast asleep at home. Once again, you're flooded with empathy. The advent of miniature motion cameras like GoPro can deliver the point of view of everything from your walk to work to your alpine ski jump stunts. Well, can these same hotshot POV cameras open a door into the experience of something like homelessness? It's the literal proposition being tested in a new project out in the Bay Area. We will speak with a homeless man who is collaborating with some tech workers in San Francisco to try and convey a day in the life of a homeless person in America. We will also be sharing moments when some of you experienced the power of empathy. And we will peek at the revolution taking place in first-class airline environments, things you'll never see, and look at the preparations for the Boston Marathon next week. But first, with expectations for a deal non-existent in those four-party talks in Geneva on the Ukraine crisis, the negotiators actually managed yesterday to produce an agreement. The mission? De-escalation of the standoff between Russia and Ukraine. It's a start.
I don't think we can be sure of anything at this point. I think there is the possibility, the prospect, that diplomacy may de-escalate the situation, and we may be able to move towards what has always been our goal, which is let the Ukrainians make their own decisions about their own lives.
It's President Obama reacting to the deal yesterday. We reached out to former National Security Advisor to President Jimmy Carter, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's now an advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says this de-escalation deal is one thing, but the ultimate goal has to be finding a special status for Ukraine that recognizes its unique proximity to and entanglement with Russian geography and history.
It seems to indicate at least some limited accommodation on the most immediate practical issues. As far as I can tell, as of now, it doesn't address the larger issue of the long-term relationship of Ukraine to Europe, to Russia, whether it's possible to have some sort of an understanding between East and West, and of course involving Ukraine itself, regarding some sort of a somewhat special status for Ukraine, which I have been advocating, something modeled on Finland. But in any case, it is a hopeful signal that at least on the practical and immediate level, some sort of an understanding is being reached regarding the conduct of some of the affected people.
We'll talk about the Finland model that you've proposed in just a moment, but Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in his statements, has suggested that all illegal military formations must be dissolved. That's his understanding of this framework. Who decides what is an illegal military formation? And would that include military groups that Russia may have sent across the border, if there are any?
Well, I would certainly assume so, and you're absolutely right and very perceptive in making that point. I would think the guys in these masks on their faces should certainly be included. Now, of course, I understand the Russians have been concerned about some of the more right-wing elements in the Maidan coalition. And obviously, I think Lavrov has them foremost in mind. But I have to assume that the Russian equivalents are very much included also.
Let's look long-term here. You suggested that some sort of model is going to have to be developed for a Ukraine that is not in NATO, but is also not annexed or carved up by Russia. You suggested Finland. I'm wondering, though, in the case of Finland, this is a country that's much more homogenous than Ukraine. It has a robust tech economy, whereas Ukraine is really a multi-ethnic population that has had movable borders over the last 100 years. The groups within Ukraine have always been competitive. And economically speaking, you know, there is no, self-sustaining economic engine inside Ukraine. It's really much more desperate than Finland is.
It is much more desperate than Finland. But it's a desperation created by mismanagement of what potentially are major assets. Ukraine could be easily a breadbasket for Europe. And in fact, the Chinese are showing interest in having it as a breadbasket for China. It has an industry on which the Russians are relying quite a bit, and that makes it productive, and they get paid for it. It has a good labor force, a really hard-working labor force. It just has been totally mismanaged by its recent leadership, which was really a kleptomaniac leadership, in which the people at the top enriched themselves beyond any level of decency or competitive rivalries. It's a scandal, but it can be corrected. But the Ukrainians will have to tighten their belts and work hard if they want to be independent. Nothing comes free in this world, and independence has to be earned. It's not a gift.
Annexation is also not free. The Russians will pay a significant bill in Crimea to raise salaries and to subsidize industries that will no longer be subsidized by the Ukrainians. Can they afford to do that in eastern Ukraine with the industrial resources in Donetsk?
Well, I don't envisage the Russians keeping the eastern part of Ukraine as part of an agreement. I see no reason why Ukraine should be partitioned. And it's a little bit of a sort of myth that the Ukrainians are multinational. First of all, they're Ukrainian, though some speak Ukrainian, others speak Russian. There is a Russian minority in Ukraine, but by the way, there is an even larger minority of Ukrainians living in Russia. Should they have a special status? Don't let the Russians pose as great promoters of ethnic and linguistic autonomy unless they practice it themselves. An international arrangement that endures has to recognize certain symmetries of responsibilities and obligations.
Finally, let's go back to 1979 in the Carter administration, the reaction by the U.S. to the invasion of Afghanistan. It was pretty much a series of sanctions and, of course, the boycott of the Moscow Olympics. Would you do anything beyond that in confronting Vladimir Putin here? You've had some strong criticism for some U.S. measures to confront and react to what's going on in Ukraine.
Well, we certainly haven't done as much as we did then. In all fairness, we had greater flexibility then. But gradually, I think we probably will be moving towards more sanctions and more direct aid for Ukraine if this issue is not resolved somewhat along the lines that I have been advocating, which seems to me to be a formula for a reasonable and workable compromise. And much depends on that regard on Putin, whether he is a rational player or whether he's acting emotionally, impetuously. There is some suspicion that that was the case with Crimea, and perhaps it created an excessive dose of self-confidence and sort of victory complex. But I think, as you've just very rightly pointed out, Putin and certainly his associates, and particularly the new business class, are realizing that if Russia slides into a prolonged conflict with the West, economically it certainly is not ready to sustain it. Absolutely not.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Zbigniew Brzezinski served as National Security Advisor to President Carter. He's now an advisor to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Now to Nigeria, where this week dozens of people were killed in bombings in the capital city of Abuja, bombings blamed on the Islamist group Boko Haram. But on top of that, there is an unfolding hostage situation this week. 100 girls taken from a secondary school, their whereabouts uncertain. The terrorist message is clear, though. Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden, and the education of girls in Nigeria is a powerful symbol of Nigeria's embrace of modernity. Bronwyn Bruton joins us, Deputy Director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How sharp is this sort of targeting of young girls being educated in Nigeria as sort of central to the mission of Boko Haram?
It's hard to know, frankly, what is central to the mission of Boko Haram because they don't really have a coherent ideology and they don't really have coherent political objectives. But hundreds of schools in the north of Nigeria have had to be closed because of the threat that Boko Haram poses to school children. And these girls who were kidnapped actually had been sent home like all the other female school children of northern Nigeria and had just been called back to school to sit their exams, basically because it's so unsafe for kids to be in class.
What can be the outcome for these young girls and women? There are all kinds of very, very terrifying rumors about what might happen to them. Is there any way of tracking what the demands might be for their release?
It's not necessarily likely that there will be demands. Boko Haram is known for kidnapping for ransom, so it's possible that they would accept a ransom in exchange for some of the girls to be released, but it's much more likely that what we're looking at is a scenario like you would have seen in Uganda with the LRA. These are girls who would be kidnapped to be used as porters, as wives, as sex slaves, probably not as fighters. But to do any number of tasks that are useful to the fighters, and frankly, probably to be very horribly abused in the process.
Is there any level of security that the government of President Goodluck Jonathan could actually provide that would cause parents to have any sort of confidence that they could send their daughters to schools in Nigeria?
You know, unfortunately, it's been quite the contrary. The Nigerian government has sent in a large number, thousands of troops to the north and has declared a state of emergency in the northern territories. But unfortunately, those troops have been accused of massive human rights violations, shooting hundreds of people illegally in detention, burning down whole villages. They're not likely to make anybody feel better. I actually think they're making the situation much worse.
So what's the breaking point here, or is this just a slide into chaos, not unlike what's going on in Congo?
I would be reluctant to say that it's likely to get that bad. I think, you know, Boko Haram is a truly horrifying and terrifying entity, and it's very likely that it will persist for a very long time because it is an area of Nigeria that is fairly lawless. And it's also, it's a border territory. So it's very easy for Boko Haram, again, to do what the LRA did in Uganda, which is to jump over borders so that the Nigerian forces can't pursue them. That means that they're very hard to defeat. They also, shockingly enough, do have some public support. They are able to hide and come out at will.
We saw with the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda that at various points, they were the focus of people online throughout the world as something that needed to be stopped. Is there any chance that the West or the U.S. or the global community has a role to play in rolling back Boko Haram?
I hope so. Genuinely, I was very heartened by the attention that Joseph Kony received. And I think that Boko Haram is equally terrible. And more than the LRA, it's the threat that is unfolding now. This isn't a group that was mostly dangerous 10 years ago. This is a group that is becoming stronger by the day. And I think that if Americans were really familiar with what Boko Haram is doing, things like, for example, in February, they burned 59 school children to death in their beds for no reason. It's a really nihilistic, senseless violence that is increasingly directed at kids. I think that people would be really horrified and very supportive of action.
An invisible sort of terror war in Nigeria made visible by this hostage situation. We'll see what the profile is going forward. Bronwyn Bruton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bronwyn Bruton is the Deputy Director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with the New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On Monday, the 118th Boston Marathon will be like no other. The first race after the tragic bombings will be an emotional reflection of that other marathon a year ago that was like no other before it. There will be 36,000 runners this time, and one of the last will be longtime race director Dave McGillivray. He likes to wait for all the runners to finish up before he hits the course in the evening, turning down Boylston Street with the last tired runners long after dark. Dave is Mr. Empathy regarding his marathon runners. He's run 41 Boston marathons and overseen the last 26, and he's really feeling it this year.
Quite honestly, John, I've never seen anything or experienced anything like this. I don't know that there'll be, or has been, or will ever be, another sporting event that'll have this level of emotion than we'll experience on April 21st in Boston.
You know, they say, coaches say, that, you know, if you're getting a headwind in a long-distance race or if you encounter a hill, You really embrace that hill. You lean into the wind. You take it on as a way to get through it. Have you leaned into the changes this year, or have you tried to keep it the same? Not really acknowledge that this is a very different race visually.
I agree with the coaches who sort of have that sort of philosophy. 35 years ago, I ran across the United States, and I always thought, once I hit the Rocky Mountains, man, this is going to be brutal. And the opposite happened because I was in the moment. You know, I'm finally here. The anxiety leading up to it was daunting. But once you were there, you say, I'm gonna put my head down. And I'm gonna blast through this. Obviously, the big part challenge for us on the organizational side is just, you know, the level of enhanced security and what that is and what that means. And, you know, do you build the security around the event or do you build the event around security? And it's been a balancing act.
You know, I'm thinking back to the state of emergency, the lockdown, the streets of Boston that week that, you know, were filled with armored vehicles. You're not talking gun-lined streets, are you, in Boston on race day? And what about the finish line? Is the security going to interfere with the emotional reunions of people crossing that finish line and going into the arms of their loved ones?
Again, we leave public safety to our public safety officials. We work in collaboration, obviously, with them from the federal side to the state side to the cities and towns. All that being said, all our discussions have always been about that delicate balance between just ensuring the safety of everyone, protecting everyone involved or near the event, but at the same time, wanting to continue to maintain that family, fun, friendly environment. So there'll be enhanced security for sure, but you're not going to see armored cars and, you know, rifle-bearing soldiers and police officers at every corner.
But your family's going to stay home?
Yeah, everyone has to deal with this in their own way. I mean, I had an 8-year-old son in the bleachers, and, you know, he obviously saw everything, as did my daughter, as did my wife. And the marathon of 2013 has not left my environment. I mean, I eat, sleep, and drink, you know, the marathon. You know, we haven't stopped working on the race since April 15th. It's just been constant. So they haven't had a chance to sort of just recover from it themselves. And it's my wife and my and their decision that, you know, they just want to spend the day and have fun. It's their way of handling this, which I'm supportive of.
Dave, how will the finish line be different? Will you need a special credential? Will people be allowed to carry bags? Will there be search teams, metal detectors?
I think from the outside looking in, it'll look the same. I mean, the physical structures and, you know, the real estate in and of itself. At the same time, you know, yeah, I mean, there'll be additional security, and people who get into the security area need to be appropriately credentialed. And those outside the security area, there'll be checkpoints. I think it's going to work well.
It's our understanding, though, that the marathon coach at Tufts won't be allowed to be at the finish line to greet all of his runners, as he's done for nearly a decade. Is that because of security?
No, not really. It's more, you have to understand, the 100th running of the Boston Marathon, we had 38,000 people. And, John, for about 2 years, all people talk to me about is, how are you going to do that? You know, that small little venue that you have, you know, we have no more real estate to do business with today than they had 100 years ago when they had 200 people on this course. And now we're putting 38,000 people on it. And so we really need to be sure that the race goes efficiently and without gridlock and bottlenecks and stuff. So even if, you know, there was no heightened level of security, we would have had to take measures like this just because of just the lack of space to be able to do it. Mm.
So we're at mile 17, all right? And there's a runner out there who's looking around, seeing the crowds, remembers last year, and all of a sudden they get this tightness in their chest. They're a little bit scared. They're really worried. Whoa, I really don't know what's going on out there. Be the coach in their ear to get them to mile 26.
Well, again, I guess it all depends on what actually is going on. I've always felt there's two types of pain. There's challenging pain and wanting pain. So if this individual is in distress and is in trouble, then they had to heed those warnings and pull themselves into a medical tent along the way. But if it's more just an emotional thing, you know, it's interesting. I always feel that if you cut yourself and it scars, the scar tissue is stronger than the original skin. And I feel emotions are the same way. And that once you've gone through something, you know, if you have a positive attitude, you can come out the other side stronger as a result for it. Therein lies the moniker, Boston Strong. You know, personally, I'm looking forward to directing it, and then I'm looking forward to running it myself later on that day and being the last finisher again this year.
Dave McGillivray, thanks so much. Good luck.
Thanks very much, John.
Dave McGillivray is the longtime race director of the Boston Marathon. Here's another example of empathy for folks struggling in a different kind of marathon, life.
This is Sharon Green from Wareham, Massachusetts. For months, we had hauled water in every day because our well had run dry. Our neighbors, without us asking, paid for us to be hooked up to town water. They dug the trench. They refused to take a penny in return. Mike and Sharon, still thank you very much and still enjoy the water that we have today because of your kindness.
Any expression of empathy you're grateful for, 8778-MY-TAKE, or leave a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
There are 8 million stories in a naked city.
That's right. Some good news for the Affordable Care Act. From a rocky start, 8 million people have now signed up for health insurance. But the bigger headline might be that 35% of those 8 million are under the age of 35, a pool of younger citizens paying premiums and a large chunk of the chronically uninsured under the umbrella of the ACA. What's not to love here, Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Welcome.
Hey, John. Shout out to Curtis Blow at the top there. How are you?
Great. So what is not to love? These were the main goals of the Affordable Care Act, get a lot of people signed up and get a lot of them young and healthy to support the pool financially.
Yeah, well, what's not to love about the policy of Obamacare is starting to dwindle. What's not to love for Democrats in the election is a far different story because there are no signs that all this good news for the policy is going to help them politically when it comes to November. They're still in trouble. But let's get back to some of the numbers that the president announced yesterday as he strode into the briefing room to talk to reporters. You mentioned 8 million people signed up. We're also seeing a slowdown in healthcare premium costs. Now, they go up every year. They have for the last 30 years. Healthcare premiums never go down. The question is, can you get them to slow down? And they are slowing down to about 7% projected for next year. The year before, they were predicting sort of 8-10%. So those appear to be slowing down. Whether or not that's thanks to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is another question. But you can see the advantage in saying costs are slowing down. There's some other numbers too.
Let's talk about the number that we spoke about back in 2010, you know, virtually every day, and that was the number of people uninsured. It was also a number that the Democrats ran on during the presidential campaign in 2008. Any chance that those 8 million or a large chunk of those 8 million gets subtracted from the chronically uninsured, or is there no way to tell at this point?
Some of them, we don't know exactly how many yet. Now, this is the difference between how many of the people who signed up for coverage had other coverage before versus how many were completely uninsured. And we don't know the exact number yet, but there is some new polling information, especially from Gallup out this week, that suggests that the number of uninsured people is falling, and not just in Medicaid. You would expect in those states where Medicaid expanded, say, okay, more people get in the canoe, that of course the number of uninsured would drop. And it has. But there is some new indication that a fraction now of the drop in the uninsured are new people signing up for coverage under the subsidy program in the exchanges of Obamacare that they didn't have access to before. That's estimated at around 2-2.5 million, but we don't know for sure yet.
You know, I'm thinking that if we look at that 8 million number and agree with your stipulation that the 2014 election is going to be all about Obamacare and there's not going to be anything to modify the vitriol from the Republicans in criticizing the act. But by the time you get to 2016, do those 8 million translate into, hello, Hillary Clinton voters?
Many of them may. Now, you haven't heard a lot from Hillary Clinton, the original architect of Hillary Care. Boy, I remember those days, I'm sorry to say, about the benefits and risk of the Affordable Care Act. Hey, she was Secretary of State. She doesn't have to say anything about that right now. Keep your powder dry, says the good politician. But by 2016, whether it's Hillary or Joe Biden or somebody we don't know about, the political reality of Obamacare going forward, and we know a lot from these numbers to say now it's going to have solid enough ground not to die under its own weight, what they call the death spiral. Obamacare is going to be around in 2016. We know that. So now your question, every 8 million or 10 million or 12 million, many of them, a huge fraction, maybe 6 million of those, or let's say 4 million, are people getting subsidies, John, getting health care they didn't have before, getting help to pay for it. Do they want to vote to lose that benefit? Big question in 2016. I'll bet you very few of them will vote to take away a benefit they're enjoying.
Nobody votes down their own benefits, that's for sure. Todd Zwillich, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Good Friday movies with Rafer Guzman of the Movie Date podcast and Kristen Meinzer, producer for the Sporkful podcast, also co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
So for Good Friday, we've got Life After Death. Yes, so one fairly scary metaphor of that. Two words for you. Johnny Depp, the movie Transcendence.
Can you prove you're self-aware?
That's a difficult question, Dr. Tiger. Can you prove that you are?
You got to have Morgan Freeman in a movie about the hereafter. And Johnny Depp, what do you make of this, Kristen?
Well, Johnny Depp in this movie is an artificial intelligence expert who is attacked by some anti-AI terrorists, people who fear the power of technology when it's gotten into the wrong hands. And they attack him. When he dies, he agrees to have his brain downloaded onto a whole computer system, and then trouble ensues. And I have to say, I thought it was a really fun ride. It brought up some questions that were enjoyable to ponder. Rafer looks like he's going to strangle me because he thinks this is stupid, but I totally enjoyed this movie.
How's your upload there, Rafer?
Yeah, the correct term is upload. Actually, this is the dumbest movie I've seen in a long time. I think this may be the year's first actual bomb. I think Johnny Depp's performance could be called virtual in more
really?
Ways than one.
Wow.
And it feels like it was written by like an IT guy in the 90s. They use words like fragmented and diagnostic.
Wasn't
it's
there a
terrible.
Movie from the 90s that took this premise? A Sandra Bullock movie, I believe, with Keanu Reeves. I think it was something like there's sort of living in a virtual world. And you've got her, which is a kind of a virtual relationship.
Much better film.
Much better film.
Disagree.
All right. You hated it, huh?
I hated it. I think I really, you know, it's and you've got a great cast. Rebecca Hall, Paul Bettany, Morgan Freeman. But it is terrible.
You know, I love it when you guys disagree, but I would have expected the exact opposite, that you would have hated it, Kristen.
I just think
Rafer.
It's a silly, fun ride. I'm not saying it's a perfect movie. There are definitely some logic issues in some of it, but my goodness, it was so enjoyable.
Chill out,
some
Rafer.
Just have some fun. Just have some fun. Sit back
do you
and
like,
eat some
do you
popcorn.
Like the line where she says, I'm going to upload him like a song or a movie?
Ooh, now we're getting into it here. Oh, I like
this.
This
is a guy who likes a movie about a girl who a guy who fell in love with a girl who's an operating system.
That was was actually plausible. There's nothing in this film that's plausible.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
it
always has to be the truth to be wonderful.
Needs
not true.
More error messages, I guess.
Yes.
All right. The second offering here that I definitely want you to argue about here is Heaven is for Real. Greg Kinnear. I love Greg Kinnear. Let's listen.
If you punch somebody, there must have been a good reason for it.
They were making fun of Colton. They made fun about him sitting on Jesus' lap.
Honey, you know you should have turned the other cheek, though, right?
I did turn his other cheek when I hit him.
A little more biblical here. Heaven is for Real. What did you think, Rafer?
Well, Greg Kinnear plays Pastor Todd Burpo. This is based on the supposedly true story of his son who entered emergency surgery and woke up with reports of a visit to heaven. It was a huge bestseller several years ago. This is the big screen version. You know, I remember when Oh God came out, another film about, you know, sort of a religious experience that you could not quite prove. I really loved that movie because it made religion into kind of a personal experience.
This one's really dogmatic, and I feel like it's trying to prove to you over and over that, yes, this boy went to heaven. There's no way to prove that, and I feel like the movie is asking me to be a credulous idiot the entire time I'm watching it, and I didn't appreciate that. I thought it was a pretty bad film.
Who does heaven here? Industrial Light and Magic, or does it have its own special effect?
It feels very low budget. In fact, to me, it felt very much direct-to-video, like it was designed for Sunday school classes, and specifically for a specific version of Christian translation that is very white, very rural, and very heterosexual. And so I don't think it's going to speak to everybody.
All right. That movie I was thinking of, The Net, with Sandra Bullock. Also, bad movie about the computer word. What's on the podcast this Easter weekend, Kristen?
Well, we're going to talk about Fargo, which has just become a TV series, and other movies or other TV shows that were inspired by movies that are both good and bad.
I'm dying to ask you, do the Coen brothers have anything to do with this series?
They're executive producers.
Oh, well,
yeah.
Of course. All right. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John. You too.
This is the dumbest movie I've seen in a long time. I think this may be the year's first actual bomb.
Coming up, a world that most people never see, largely because they choose not to look. The world of the homeless, revealed by some cameras, opening a web window onto struggles on the street. But here's a world you probably never see, because unless you have $10,000 for a ticket, there's no way in.
Emirates offers you first-class private suites on all our newest aircraft. Long-haul air travel is an absolute pleasure.
Emirates First Class. Oh, sure, you're going to crash the mega seats up front in those jumbos. Right. Good luck with that.
Coach passengers are not allowed up here in first class. It's policy. I'm sorry.
Oh, this is a very strict plane that I'm on.
Sir, she can have my seat, okay? Everyone should experience first class at least once in their lives, and Annie shouldn't miss out just because she can't afford it.
No, ma'am, I'm afraid that's not allowed.
Help me, I'm poor.
No.
For the rest of us humans, paying $10,000 to share a bit of a metal tube with 12 other people for a few hours, even if the seats do turn into beds, might seem like a complete ripoff. Why doesn't it seem that way to the super rich? Well, the rich are different, right? But there's some magic at work as well, and it's revealed in a fascinating piece in this week's New Yorker magazine. Staff writer David Owen joins us. David, welcome.
Hello.
There's a really challenging design question to making seats in first class both profitable and deliver the illusion that it's luxury everywhere you look. How does that work, and how does this one design firm seem to have everything figured out?
Well, it is interesting, because if you think about it, if you were taken to a hotel room and told that you'd be sharing it with 11 other people, and each of whom would be sleeping within a few feet of your own little skinny bed, you wouldn't be thrilled. And yet, many times people who travel halfway around the world in super fancy seats on airplanes remember the flight as one of the best parts of their trip. So it takes some doing, and it's not cheap. The first class seats on some long haul airplanes can cost well over $500,000 a seat to make. And yet those seats play an important role on airlines, because the passengers in the front of the plane are critical to the economic health of airlines.
What is it in the cost of the first class seats that has to do with safety? What are the requirements that are in some cases really bizarre?
There's a lot. It's surprising. And if you think about it, how safe really airplanes are in survivable accidents. When an airplane goes off a runway and tips over, the landing gear collapse and it crashes, the plane is moving very fast and it's a huge object and it often runs into big things. And yet people typically walk away. The reason is that there are huge numbers of requirements, safety requirements, that have to do especially with those seats. They have to stay in place. They can't they have to survive an impact equal to 16 times the force of gravity. They can't pop up and block aisles or fall on people. And when people sitting in those seats are thrown forward by turbulence or by the impact of a hard landing, they have to be protected. And that can be especially a challenge in the front of the plane, where there's a longer distance that a head and torso can travel before it runs into something solid. Back in the back, you're kind of protected by the seat that's right in front of you. Passengers don't even realize this, that many seats in business class and first class actually have an airbag, like in a car.
And as you write, some of the early first class compartments were in the back to get them away from the noise of the engines in the early days. The design firm in London that you profile in this piece really goes back to the history of railroad cars. And it occurs to me that really for a century now, designers have been delivering this illusion that being cramped in a railroad car or an airplane seat is a very special kind of romantic luxury.
That's right. And it's you look back, you watch an old movie and you see those old train cars. But the firm that I write about, James Park Associates, JPA Design, began by creating train cars for a revival of the Orient Express. And that's a complicated task, too, because you build these train cars that look like, you know, sort of miniature Downton Abbeys going along with all wood paneling and everything. But everything also has to meet very stringent safety requirements.
It's amazing, though. This is designed for the worst-case scenario. I mean, all the stuff that makes the cost is really for a scenario that everyone hopes never, ever happens, and it goes way, way beyond seatbelts. Let's talk for a second about how the airlines themselves have actually branded themselves on the basis of the legend of their own first-class seats. I mean, Virgin Atlantic has done an incredible job branding itself as having all kinds of amenities, and the big airlines in like Singapore and in Asia are going crazy with this, way ahead of the U.S.
Way ahead of the U.S. American carriers are trying to catch up, but the Middle Eastern and the Asian airlines tend to be way ahead. And they're also ahead in service. American carriers never have the same kind of reputation for attentive service.
Well, David, stipulating right at the outset that we have no chance whatsoever of experiencing any of these, what is the most ridiculous amenity that you experienced in producing this piece?
Well, that I experienced in the sense of reading about it or hearing about it. I think the most amazing is on Emirates, in some of their first-class cabins on Emirates, you can take a shower. You can take a five-minute shower before you land. And that's an incredible luxury because every ounce of weight has a cost. Samoa Airlines charges you by the kilo. They weigh you and your luggage, and you're charged. Their slogan is a kilo is a kilo is a kilo. And it can add huge costs. It's an expensive amenity. You can also, on several airlines, just kind of combine these suites that are already luxurious and turn them into kind of a honeymoon suite. There's some pretty remarkable amenities on a number of airlines.
Well, the design magic that delivers the illusion that you're actually not in a metal tube for a few hours, totally at the mercy of a staff of an airliner, and that's what first class is all about. And you know, $10,000 a ticket at least, it seems to deliver. David Owen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
David Owen, staff writer for The New Yorker. His profile of the design firm that has revolutionized first class travel around the world is in the current issue of The New Yorker. Next up, sometimes in life, what people really need is a hug.
Hi, this is Sue from Hillsborough, New Jersey. When I was 17, I returned to my waitressing job after a vacation, only to find my boyfriend in the arms of someone else. So shocked, I stumbled into the restaurant kitchen. Another waitress wordlessly embraced me, and because of her, I kept it together and finished my shift.
All right, Sue. From Ardsley, New York, I was hit by a truck while riding a bike. The truck ran over my bike, drove off. It was raining. One man called the police and waited for them to arrive with me. He even gave me one of the dozen bagels he had with him. Another man sped down the street to get the license plate number. People helping people. Coming up, opening a window on the unseen experience of homelessness.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There is a competition going on in America's cities, and it's not pretty. Workers competing for housing in Seattle and San Francisco, New York and Boston and other cities. An influx of highly paid workers in growing industries raises housing prices and marginalizes middle and working class workers, forcing them farther from the city or in some cases right onto the streets. The parallel universe of homelessness in urban America is there if you know where to look for it. In New York, most of the homeless are in homeless shelters of some kind. On the West Coast, unsheltered homeless people living on the streets is the norm. In San Francisco, more than 61% of the homeless population is unsheltered. They walk like shadows amongst the commuters from San Francisco's most desirable neighborhoods, working in places like the tech bubble of Silicon Valley. Tech entrepreneur Kevin Adler hopes to burst that bubble and make homelessness more visible. His Homeless GoPro project gives GoPro cameras to homeless volunteers to document their experiences, opening a window on the web to see the reality of homelessness with the same HD resolution people use to take video of their ski vacations and snowboarding stunts. Kevin Adler and his homeless collaborator cameraman Adam Reichardt spoke with us about their plan that won't give anyone a home, but it might give the community something almost as valuable.
One of the reasons I got involved in this is that I've noticed in the last few years, I've been homeless on and off for almost 6 years, and selling the street sheet here in San Francisco, I found that it's almost like doing a social experiment where you get to learn a lot about people's behavior. And I've noticed over, especially the last 2 or 3 years, that people are really starting to lose their empathy and compassion towards humanity, not just in homelessness in general, but in homelessness is a big part of it.
You guys, the Bay Area Reporters did a story on me last week. I'm having all my teeth surgically extracted next Wednesday, and I'm trying to get up enough for a month's rent. Have a good day, guys. The Bay Area Reporters did a story on me last week. I'm getting all my... You're having all my teeth surgically extracted next week.
I'm really tubed up. I've got...
You have a good day, honey.
To Kevin Adler, how do you think empathy plays into this, and how do GoPro cameras on the street, and again, we're just at the beginning of this experiment, how do GoPro cameras and images that they provide engage this sense of empathy?
Yeah, I think empathy is a very powerful force. It's a way to have a more of an established shared concept of human dignity, which I think is important for all the other types of service organizations that do provide the essential homes and shelters and food and other indispensable needs of homeless individuals. You know, this is a piece of technology that a lot of people, young professionals, have, and it's very accessible to us. We'll go on a weekend and capture some footage from snowboarding or surfing. My life's not that exciting, but, you know, conceivably. And then share it with our friends. And I think homeless individuals have, you know, their own lives, and we don't yet have a great snapshot of what their daily experiences and interactions are. So the idea would be to use a little bit of technology to extend that and empower their voices and to share their stories.
How do you respond to the reaction that, oh, great, here's a California tech guy with a technology solution for homelessness? That's really inspiring, but it's not going to actually solve the problem. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, I'd start first, you know, with the origins of the project. So my uncle Mark was homeless for 30 years. And he lived on and off the streets. He had schizophrenia, and he died about 10 years ago. He was found by himself in a halfway house. So I think empathy is a pretty good thing to build everywhere. And certainly in kind of the divisive environment in which we're in, with debate around tech workers and affordable housing, we're not wanting to be on either side of the debate. We are all people. We're all in this together. We're one city. And this is a way to help better connect the city through a little bit of empathy and a little bit of technology.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the competition for low-income housing and the tech workers who do compete for those properties and, by some accounts, drive up the price. Adam Reichardt, do you see tech workers as, competing for homes, driving up rents, creating some of the problems that might be the cause of your homelessness on some level?
I wouldn't say the cause of my homelessness, but the cause of me getting housed again, yes. Because it's like I just had some medical procedures done this week, and I had to get a place, so I went and rented a hotel for a week. And it cost me $350 for a week in a room with no toilet, no sink, no shower. And the same room like 3 to 5 years ago would have been $100, $150.
Now, those are the kinds of images that, if you recorded them on the GoPro, might make a pretty powerful economic point about the competition among workers in the Bay Area. Is there a concern, Kevin, that through this GoPro technology that people will be able to observe the lives of homeless people safely through a screen on their smartphone or their computer, when maybe the more powerful empathy would be to see them, you know, in 3D, high resolution, in the places and on the streets where they actually live, encountering them in the course of a day.
You know, I'd kind of refer to something Adam told me after the first San Francisco Chronicle article ran, which is he said, the money has increased a little, but the humanity has increased a lot. It's lifting my spirits and making me wanting to better myself. And he said he estimated, and Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, but that 75 to 100 people over the last few days have recognized him, expressed appreciation for what he's doing, and, you know, said, Adam, I've seen you here for years, but I haven't had a better sense of who you are and your backstory.
Adam, what was it like to experience that?
You know, it's been a really wild week. The first day that me and Kevin talked and I thought about this afterwards, I thought in my own head, you know, if I could just touch one person's life out of all this, it'll make me satisfied that I did something with this project. And I just wanted to share with your audience that, you know, some people have sent me some really inspiring affirmations and that I've inspired them. And that a couple of the messages have even said that they were going to, like, get involved. One guy said he was going to volunteer at a homeless place in Germany. And another guy said that he was going to volunteer locally here. And you know what? That makes this whole project, makes me feel good in my heart about this whole project that, you know, I feel like to a point we already accomplished a little bit of something.
Is your mission to stop being homeless, or is it bigger than that?
It's a lot bigger than that. In my eyes, I want to be out the streets, but my big scenario in this would be I want to be able to wake up a lot of people, make them see what this is really like out here, that it's not all fun and games.
What do you think visually, Adam, has surprised Kevin the most about the day-to-day realities of your life?
I think probably how many people ignore you. You know, anywhere from 75 to 100 people walking past me within a minute or two. You know, I do pretty busy areas, and 90% of the people, exactly, you're invisible when you're there. I've sort of gotten used to that over the years, but at the same time, I'd like to be able to wake people's eyes up.
Kevin, let's talk about your uncle for a moment. For most of those 30 years when he was on the street and suffering from mental illness, there were no GoPro cameras really available to document his story, right?
No, and you know, he passed away 10 years ago, and this is why I think technology like GoPro can be so exciting. I know Uncle Mark as the person who showed up at Thanksgiving and Christmas, always the most family-oriented person in my household, who remembered every birthday and gave me a, you know, eagle bandana before he passed away on my birthday, just a few days after he passed away, he sent it to me. That's my image of Mark. I have no idea what his life was like day to day, except the stories I heard from my dad. And I think in part, you know, that was an issue. You know, I think myself and a lot of us who have been fortunate enough not to have to face homelessness directly really don't have a sense of what it's like. And if we are all connected, we're all, you know, in it together, it helps to walk a little bit in their shoes.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having us on the show, John.
Kevin Adler is a co-founder of the Homeless GoPro Project. Adam Reichardt is a homeless man and a participant in that project. Where does empathy come from in your experience? Dino from Austin, Texas. I was going to drop out of a class once. The director of the program came all the way to my house, took me back. I finished the program mainly because of her support that day when I wasn't up to continue due to social anxiety. Your empathy stories, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Easter. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.